If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. So I went to see Barbie, and like Mary and I don't go to the cinema very often because obviously, I mean, we've managed to palm the kids off on their granny for a few days. So we were like, yeah, we got the place to ourselves.
Oh, lucky you.
After, do you know what though, right? So they drive you a bit mad, don't they, all the time. Like, and then when they're gone, you're like, I miss it. But you don't miss the stress and the strain of having to shout at them every 10 minutes. You just like, there's just a void. So we've got over that. Like this morning we watched telly in bed and we were like, we should be shouting at children. Don't you feel like we should be shouting at children right now? Because it's that sort of time when you're like, we should be getting ready for school and just shouting. So yes, we decided to go to the cinema. And first of all, like I was probably one of the least pink people there on account of not wearing any pink and being like a middle-aged man or whatever. And there were lots of people really embracing it. But I was totally up for it because yeah. I think I respect Greta Gerwig as a director anyway. She's, absolutely. You know, I really enjoyed yeah. Little Women. There's other things that she's done. I haven't seen many of her bits, but so I knew she'd do it all right. And basically, I just loved it. I gave it like a 9 out of 10 because Ken is hilarious all the way through. There's plenty of bits that make yeah. you laugh. There's some good dance moves. There's a dance battle thing. And just at the end, there's a little bit that totally made me cry. So I felt like it had everything.
Well, there you
really.
Go.
I think...
That's good.
Regardless of what kind of little girl you've been, whether you've been a big, bald, but hairy little girl with a beard like me or a legit little girl in your past, I think Barbie's worth a look.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to check it out. I mean, I had an entire suitcase full of Barbies growing up that now my daughter plays with when she goes visits her grandma. So
do they?
We've got vintage Barbies.
Yeah, are they like classic Barbies as well? Did you have? Because she goes like, what's her name? Margot Robbie is stereotypical Barbie. Mm-hmm. So that's the one that she's known. She's like classic Barbie, but.
Oh, yeah. I had the classic Barbie. But I was really into Barbie and the Rockers. I don't know if you remember them. They were like a rock group. And so they had very cool late 80s, early 90s clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I had the whole band.
Nice.
So, yeah, I had lots of classic Barbies, but, you know, as a brown-haired human, I also preferred some of the less classical blonde, blue-eyed Barbies so that I could act like I was them. So yeah. My sister was the classic.
Oh, is she? Is she still? She's so perfect. I never...
No. But she's still blonde and blue-eyed.
When we had over here, I mean, there was Barbie, obviously, but we also had He-Man. And I think you had He-Man over there around the same time anyway, right? And the Master of the Universe.
Oh, yeah. I loved He-Man. And absolutely.
The funny thing was my best friend when I was growing up lived across the road from me called Gareth. His brother Tom was always into She-Ra rather than He-Man. And we were always like, oh, he must be totally gay because he's into She-Ra. I mean, he is. Fair play. But the funny thing was, we're like playing with the guy with the massive muscles and the bright suntan and all that sort of thing in the tiny shorts. And we're just like completely going about it the wrong place. But no, fair play.
Well, I was way more into He-Man than She-Ra.
You see, that's probably the white sedan. If I'd have known what Barbie had to offer. But that's a good starting. How are you anyway? So we concluded that we've known each other for a long time. And yet this is the first time we've ever spoken.
Yep, which is exciting. But yes, we've known each other a long time. We've done a number of things together, actually, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm good. It's been a crazy busy summer, but a good summer.
Are you? Yeah, so you're on summer vacation now with the kids, right?
Yeah, so we're on summer vacation. My kids have been off for quite a while, but you know, my son is older. He's 13, so he's sort of in his own world. And my daughter goes to camp, and I was teaching a summer session, so I've only been in summer for like a week.
Right. And how long do you have off before, or are you still artisting throughout the summer? Do you have definite days when you're like, today I'm artist duetter, and then other days I'm...
Yes. I have studio days that I go to the studio or do my work. Yeah. So I have designated artist days. I like that. These are my artist days.
Today I'm artist duetta. Tomorrow I am stereotypical duetta.
Yes. I'm the many hats Joetta sometimes and the artist hat Joetta other times, which also has many hats. Mm. So, so I have certain days of the week that I have designated as studio days, and they end up shifting because I teach. But I try to be in my studio at least 2 days a week, and I prefer 3 days a week, but that doesn't always work out.
And what are you teaching at the moment then? What's the course and stuff?
I teach various courses. I was teaching drawing and photography this summer. So drawing one and photo one. Those are classes I teach pretty regularly. I also teach a visual foundations course for a graduate digital media program. I've taught that for like 7 years. And then I also teach a class that's called Image and Context. It's about how the context of imagery changes their meaning.
Wow.
And that's a foundational course at a college here. So, and then I teach lots of workshops in textiles, but I don't teach academically in textiles.
What's the TLDR of the Image and Context course? Give me the 2-minute summary so I can pretend I've been on it.
It's essentially understanding that the context that we observe an image in changes the way we understand its meaning. And so they work from all found or appropriated images. And by recontextualizing the images through different mediums, they create content and meaning that is interesting to them. And so they do a collage, an artist book, a video montage, and a public archive project. Wow. It's a great class. Mm. I would have loved to take this class when I was an 18, 19-year-old art student. It's a fascinating class to teach, and it's a really it's interesting because these kids nowadays, they know how to use, you know, they can figure out how to do everything themselves because of YouTube and all of that stuff. So we don't actually spend much time at all showing them technique. It's all about like context, conversation, and examples and critique, and we just kind of give them a whole bunch of links, and then they figure out what they want to do from those links. It's an interesting class.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. And I suppose the fact that they're working with found objects means that gives them a starting point rather than them maybe having to think of a starting point for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they're given like a lot of different places they could go. So they definitely, I think it's better if they have a idea of a little bit of like their interests or what they want to make work about, because there's so many places you can get images. Mm. And even the place you collect images from can have meaning, right? Like if you're collecting images just from, you know, fashion magazines, that's different than if you're collecting it from historical photographs. It's a lot about talking about like having intentional choices and where you get images and what you do with images and how what they're surrounded by can affect how the viewer reads the images.
And that's
I think it's kind of intimidating to them, but it's also like a real growth. It's like really twists their brain out of high school art classes and are like, oh, I'm in a different place now.
Yeah. Because that speaks to the broader context of like art history and that kind of thing anyway as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we look at all kinds of examples of artists that work this way, and then they are taking another class at the same time that's more of an art history lens, but it's literally looking at images that are maybe of the same subject, but because of context are completely different in what they're communicating.
In all the time I've known you, you've always been like an artist and a curator and someone who thinks broadly about the subject, you know, not just like your own work, but the themes and those kind of things. And I always admired you as a curator when we started out. I'm not dissimilar that I'm a curator, but I never did art at school. I never did any of these things. Mm-hmm. So this whole like historical context and those kind of things, I kind of blethered about for a long time. And I think eventually it gets to you. Eventually you have to pay attention to where you're at and what you're doing. But I wonder whether mm-hmm. you're like you must have learned that when you started out, because you started out doing photography and illustration. Is that right?
Just photography. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I started in photography. And I went to a school that was pretty rigorous in art history context. Like you had to take a lot of art history. And so I think I always just understood my references. I knew photo history, so I understood my place in it and what I was responding to and sort of what I was coming, who were my like forebears of the type of work I did. And I think when I started to work in textiles, I really felt like I didn't have that education. Like I was making this work that had to do with textiles and textile processes, and I didn't understand like the artists that had done it before. I didn't have those reference points. I didn't know the critical discourse that was happening about it. I definitely didn't know the history of it. And so that's really one of the reasons I started my blog many years ago mm-hmm. is that it was like a way for me to force myself to do research. And so by writing about textile artists every day, which is essentially I did it daily, it was a way for me to be researching the context of textile arts and like the history and also what contemporary artists were doing within that history. And so it was my way of sort of creating that education for myself, because there's really not a lot of academic research on it, for sure. I mean, it's much better now than it was, you know, 15 years ago when I was in grad school. But the Subversive Stitching came out, the reprint came out while I was in graduate school, which was also really serendipitous because I was able to read that book, which is kind of like the only really academic book on embroidery as an art form. You know, there's a lot on quilting, and there's a lot more on some of the more specific textile practices. Obviously, there's lots on weaving. On Annie, you know, Annie Albers has written so many wonderful things, and there's a lot of other things. But yeah, so I feel like I just knew that I needed, I mean, I was in graduate school at the time too, and you know, you have to contextualize what your role is in the contemporary art world and where your place is amongst like the like arc of art history in your thesis paper. So I definitely was also like consciously doing research because that was the moment I was in my artistic career. So, but I continue. Yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with that kind of stuff.
It's interesting because like photography is considered an art form now. I don't know, I'm no expert, but photography, it feels like it took quite a long time for photography to get taken seriously as an art form. But then photography's lifespan's a lot shorter. Needlework's been around for centuries. But even now, you know, it's still quite hard, isn't it? We know lots of textile artists, but you could say maybe like 25 years ago, you could probably count their names on two hands of the big names. And then sometimes it feels like the only people who become really famous textile artists are famous artists who then start using textiles. So it still feels now like there's still like this struggle to get like legit, oh, this stuff's actually art, because it still gets pigeonholed in crafts and hobbies as hard as is humanly possible or something.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think photography still is like the ugly stepchild of art in a lot of ways. It's just that it's been able to create its own world. Like there are its own collectors, there are galleries that focus on photography, and there are people that have been able to cross over. But I still think it's definitely, you know, it's not painting. nothing is as good as painting.
That's true.
And I do agree that, I mean, for sure, textiles like is there are people that are quite established that work in textiles, but usually they have already worked in painting or sculpture, and then they start to work with textiles. I mean, I for me, I think the most frustrating thing I often see with like contemporary textiles is that it's like a show of textiles. And to me, like, especially with embroidery, it's just drawing. It's a mark making process. And so I find it most exciting when like my textile work is in a show with paintings and drawings and sculptures, because it's just a different form of making marks. And I find it a little frustrating that it's the only way that institutions really ever support textiles is in this very like genre sort of way, which is great. I mean, that's great too. And I love seeing a really well curated textile exhibition, because it shows you that textiles is everything. It's sculpture, it's drawing, it's painting, it's installation. It is all of those things. But I also have, I've definitely found it frustrating over the years that it's like, you know, why can't it also just be part of like a drawing show? There could be incredible embroideries in a drawing show, because that's what drawing is it's making marks that form an image on a surface. And I don't do paintings out of textiles, but there definitely are people that are essentially just painting with thread, that it seems like I just wish curators would open, like not textile curators, but regular sort of more traditional curators would be more open to seeing that, in addition to all the amazing textile shows, because I do think when you see a really well curated textile show, it opens people's minds up to starting to think about textiles in that way, and think about, and realize the different applications that textiles can have as a form of making. And there's always an interest, you know, most people, and I think people should, if they're making art out of textiles, have a contextual reason why they're making an art out of textiles. That, you know, that opens up a different conversation as well, which is great. So it's not that I don't like those shows. I love those shows. I almost always go to them. But I just wish, you know, when I would just go to the Met and they're showing selections from their drawing selection, or like the MFA was doing a show about a theme, that you would see textiles right there alongside all of these more, I say traditional art mediums, but then textiles has been around forever. So it is a traditional art medium.
Yeah.
Familiar, sort of generally accepted art mediums. That, you know, I feel like there's like all this like talk about sort of correcting art history, but I still think that textiles is really left out of that a lot. And I do think it has a lot to do with that. It is such a female oriented practice, historically speaking, at least in the Western tradition, that, and you know, the subjects that maybe are visited by textile artists even today, you know, a lot of artists that are working with textiles are dealing with subjects and themes, that are more closely related to like aspects of the vulnerability of life, maybe you could say. And it seems like for some reason, art with a capital A is still afraid of that for some reason. So,
yeah, it'd be nice if it got treated nonchalantly within a context, rather than being like, hey, everybody, here's some textiles, and then just going, hey, everybody, here's some art, you know, whatever it's made of.
Right. Exactly. And I think it's really exciting when that happens. Like, I have been in exhibitions like that. And for me, it's a way for people to not, like, my work isn't an embroidery. It is an embroidery, but my work that I make with textiles, they're to me, they are drawings. And so when people see them with other work that is not just textile based, then they realize that, you know, they see, oh, this is just a drawing. This is a different form of making lines on a substrate. And so then I feel like it changes the conversation about the work, because sometimes I think with textile art, the conversation just stays stuck on the craft of the making. And there's, for any artist that's making work in textiles, there's a lot of content in that work. And sometimes I think when you're talking to people, that gets left out because there's so much to say about the craft of textiles that hasn't been said and hasn't been explored in a really intelligent way. But then it can be frustrating. I think, like, for me, for instance, in graduate school, all they ever wanted to talk about was that I was a woman embroidering. They weren't concerned about all the men making giant metal sculptures. They didn't need to talk about, well, why are you making giant sculptures out of metal? They were just talking about what the metal was made, you know, what was the subject, what was the content. Whereas my critiques would be like, well, so what is your feminist statement and how do you feel about the fact that, you know, embroidery is like associated with, you know, and which obviously was content that I was interested in, but it wasn't the only content that was there. And I feel like that can happen a lot. But when a show, when a textile piece is in a room with paintings, drawings, sculptures, whatever, all of the different things, that conversation gets a little like dropped, and then the content conversation can come up, which is always what I'm more interested in.
Yeah, yeah, because you don't like
so
you
that
say,
might be selfish.
No. But like when people are making sculptures out of metal, people don't sort of look in detail at their riveting technique or whatever, do they? They don't, you know, they just accept the craft as taken, and then they move on to the story that's being told. Whereas, yeah, whether it's a tufted rug or it's a quilt or it's a bit of needle felting or a bit of hand embroidery, people are always like, well, would you look at that? Isn't that amazing? Aren't those stitches just perfect? It's like, well, yeah, thanks. But, you know, these brush strokes or this bit of pencil, you know, any competent blooming watercolor artist, we never go, oh, I love the way you bled those two shades of blue together. Because you don't, do you? You just take it and move on.
No.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? So you came into embroidery whilst doing the photography and printmaking stuff at college, right?
Yeah, well, I was in graduate school. I started to embroider. I had never embroidered before.
But it got you.
It definitely caught me. I like started to embroider for like I had a project I wanted to do, and it materially felt like the right material and the right process because it was about healing and sort of a meditative, slow process related to healing. And so I very much was like, conceptually, this is the right material to make this piece in. And I learned to do the split stitch through like a Jenny Hart, like
100%,
little
gift
box thing. Because I tried to do it without it and it was a nightmare. And so then I was like, I got to go buy a little book or something. And there were no books on embroidery really at that time. So I bought like, you know, the little gift set you could buy. I never did any of the iron on things, but I used her little book to learn the stitches. And I thought it would be like a one-off thing. I just thought I wanted to make this one piece for a lot of reasons. I was trying to make this piece and I just kind of got hooked because I loved the fact that it's portable. I love the fact that it was somewhat passive labor. Like I could pick it up and put it down. I was in graduate school, so I was like going to lectures all the time. I was going to New York City all the time being on the subway. And I was also like feeling like I needed to be making art all the time. And so it felt really conducive to all of those desires of being able to be productive while I was also like doing these other things. And I also think I ended up becoming attracted to it because my particular graduate program was very butt in the seat in the studio 8 hours a day type of graduate program. That's what they wanted out of you. And the reality is photography is not that way. Photography is about being in the world and observing and being ready to capture, at least the way I photograph, because I don't take constructed photographs. Discover or find or witness my images. And so everybody else was in the studio 8 hours a day. I'm totally like, I want to be a straight A student type of person. So I also think it was a way for me to create work that required that of me so that I could meet the sort of cultural expectation of my graduate program. So And I'm also like Midwestern, so okay. I grew up in the middle America. So, you know, the work ethic is high there. You gotta work, mm-hmm. you gotta work. Mm-hmm. And so I think also it was very attractive to that sort of sensibility in me of like, it was labor intensive and I could point at it and say, this took a lot of work.
Yeah. Picture that you've taken, even if you've spent 5 hours getting to the right place in the universe to take that photo, people are still going to be, oh, you just took a photo. Right. Whereas if you've been
right.
Cause the thing like when we did Push Stitchery, you know, in there we've got pieces mm-hmm. from your Sleeper series. And I want to know how mm-hmm. you went from small things to full size, you lying in a bed size bed type pieces. And I mean, that what was the evolution towards that?
Well, it happened pretty quickly when I started to work with images. But honestly, I always start with a photograph, so all of my images start from a photograph. And I had done a project where I documented my bed photographically every single day for a certain amount of time, and I would write this sort of confessional, sort of diaristic response to the bed. And I had been taking self-portraits that were in the domestic space. And I think I just had that image and I just envisioned it life size on a bed. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about what that would be like. How would I do that? I had just recently, because I had started to get a little bit bigger before that, but I was like pillowcase scale. Because I was working from actual photographs, and then a painter friend of mine was like, oh, well, you should project them. You should get a projector. It would be so much easier. And so I got like, you know, one of those cheap, terrible tracer things at like Michael's. They're horrible. I mean, now I use a digital projector, but, so I bought one of those and it was like being able to see these photographs at any scale was just extremely exciting because I already knew how to interpret them into embroideries by then. And so I just did it and it was very exciting. It was a totally different challenge. I had to figure out like to fill in large areas of color. I ended up using applique more because it was so time intensive to fill large areas of color with stitch. So that was when I first started to incorporate applique, was making the larger scale work. And I'm a person that like obsessively documents process. And so for that particular piece of me on the bed, it was like, again, like I had a show coming up. I knew what it was conceptually about and I wanted like a anchor piece for the gallery, like a really special new anchor piece. And I envisioned that image on the bed for this exhibition. And I didn't know if I would ever do it again. But through the process of documenting me making that image, I just became really fascinated with the body sort of lost in the space of the bed. And that because I spent so much time making this singular body, which was mine, I was really interested in how I both looked really peaceful, but I also looked dead in a lot of ways. And it made me start to just think about the bed itself as this, like, you know, it's like this really liminal space in our life where that's where we like are out, you know, we sort of drop out of our life and into our unconsciousness and our dream state. It's also where we are both, most of us are born and die. And it's also the place where we go when we're at our most vulnerable moments, but it's also like in an intimate relationship where the most powerful moments of intimacy can happen. And so I just became really interested in the bed as a, like a location and sort of as this liminal space in life. And it's also kind of fascinating that I forget the statistic now because I made this work so long ago, but I used to know the statistic of the average amount of hours we spend in our bed. It's like a lot.
Isn't it like a third of our lives or something?
It's like a third of our lives. Mm. And yet it's like the room that you close the door when guests come home. It's like the last room you renovate. it's the last room you buy new things for. It's like this forgotten, hidden space in a lot of households. So I just became really interested in that. And then I got really excited about the challenge of making the large scale work. Because I definitely, you know, embroidery is extremely time consuming. And so I really had to be much more creative about how I thought about positive and negative space, how I thought about color. And that was exciting to me. I'm definitely a person that once I know how to do something, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, I'm bored.
Right.
So it was a really exciting sort of project of how far and how big I could make an embroidery that still held up as a strong image. And they got heavier and heavier. So then that was like a structural challenge of like, how do I support all of this cloth hanging? I mean, it would be a conservator's nightmare, some of those works. Yeah. And so it was very organic, in a lot of ways, which my process is pretty intuitive and organic in general. But it really just started with an image and a suggestion to use a projector. And then it was like, for years, so that's all I did.
Have you still got them?
I still have most of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask a really dumb question? Are they like folded up?
Yeah.
Or are they like really like you still got them hung on a wall somewhere because they have to be flat?
I do not have them hung up on a wall. I wish I had enough space to just have 10-year-old work hung up on a wall because it's almost 10 years old, I think. They're rolled up.
Okay. That would make a lot of sense now that you've said that. I was thinking while you were saying that as well of, you know, like, I think it's Charon, the person who takes you across to the River Styx, the person who takes you across to the underworld, and beds as liminal spaces. They're a bit like that, aren't they? Because for a lot of people, they're the place that they lie on, and they don't come back from lying on those beds. And it's quite, there's a lot to be said for that. But then, was that the first time that you got into liminal spaces then? Because that is a theme of yours that still exists to this day, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but that was, I mean, my work changed a lot right before that. Like in graduate school, essentially I had been making work about a trauma-based subject and I didn't want to make work about that anymore. I had a very different perspective on life and I wanted to make work more about that perspective. And so in graduate school, my work shifted significantly to be that particular work was a lot about like affirmation and confession, like having a level of like acceptance and celebration of the complications that exist within intimacy.
Okay.
And that led to the bed work, and the bed work, the sleeper series did very well for me. It was in a lot of, it was exhibited a lot. It was written about, I was interviewed. And so, you know, when you have the opportunity to have a body of work that, gets a fair amount of attention, you, have to learn how to talk about it, but also you learn a lot in the process of talking about it.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it really, the level of attention it got gave me the opportunity to really reflect on the work a lot, which introduced that I was really interested in aspects of liminal space and also sort of temporal things. I think making the work really made me realize, because, you know, it would take, if I was working full time in the studio, it would take about a month, like 6 to 8 hours a day, 5 days a week sort of thing to make a piece. And so I think spending that amount of time on things, and sometimes I was working from photographs that were older, I became really acutely aware of how quickly things change, how quickly a person's face changes, or even like the sheets on your bed or the color of your wall or the house you're living in. And so I think that opened up a real awareness of the sort of ephemeral quality of our human lives. And that became, over the years, you know, also becoming a mother, I think being a parent makes you like acutely aware of the passage of time. because it's so rapid in front of you while your children are particularly young. And also time is so precious because you have none of it, as you had mentioned. That I think the process of becoming a mother also made me more aware of those things. And that's really where my work has shifted, is to sort of explore that aspect much more. But that was where it began.
So more recently, like, you've done work that is, I love this, you've done work that has been inspired by dust, and now you're very much doing work that's inspired by daylight and the way light plays on surfaces. And to me, it feels like, looking at some of the stuff you did to do with dust almost makes me think of, like, Hubble telescope images of constellations. You know, it's like these universes that exist, and with the daylight, you know, you're paying attention to things that we just don't notice because we sort of take them for granted, but those things we don't notice are also witnessing us doing things. So there's like this connection, like the way the daylight bounces off objects, they're having a conversation with objects and they're presenting a different view of objects. And what's interesting to me is you're then trying to capture that rather than the moments that are witnessed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I started to do the dust work first. Those sort of came about in a funny, I was drawing threads. Like, I had, you know, the little ortzes and stuff on my table. And I had also, this was during a period where I was not doing as much textiles, and I was really struggling with how, that is how I'm most well known. That's where a lot of opportunities come from. And I wasn't feeling like my work made sense being made in textiles anymore, because I was making work about ephemeral things and textiles take forever to make. And so I was sort of exploring what that meant for my work and where I wanted my work to be going. And it was a very complicated moment, because I would get invited to do a show or teach or share my work, and it would always be textile based, but I wasn't really making that much textile work at the time, or I wasn't as excited about that work. And so I started to draw the threads on my table. It's called, they were about undoing knots, and so it was sort of a metaphor of, maybe if I could draw these interlocking threads, I could sort of undo the knots of my life and my mind. And it really turned me on to drawing, which was not something I ever had really seriously done. I mean, I went through a traditional fine arts program, and so I was required to do a lot of drawing, but, you know, from the time I was 21, graduated undergrad, I really had not picked up a pencil to draw in, you know, 10 years or whatever, however long this was. And this drawing the threads was just sort of like a, you know, I was just trying to kind of get out of my head and let something happen. I realized that I was really interested in drawing all of a sudden. And I had also been, just again, by impulse, intuition, I was collecting the sweepings of my kitchen floor, because I couldn't believe how often I had to sweep my kitchen floor. It felt like this endless labor of never being done. And I like to walk around barefoot, but I really hate dirty floors under my bare feet. So it was this, I just was sort of flabbergasted by how dirty a floor can get in one day. And so I just started to collect them in little Ziplocs, not having any idea what I was going to do with them, because they're disgusting and gross and not beautiful at all. And then I went on a photography residency where they had a high-res scanner, and I actually took them there because I was planning on doing photograms, which is when you put something on a dark room, you know, a dark room paper, you expose it to light, and it takes the image. But those were really unsatisfying because they were black and white. All of the detail was lost. They just became these completely abstract forms, and I wanted the specificity. And so I thought of trying to do it on the scanner. And so I scanned these with a really high-res scanner and made cameraless photographs of them. And to my shock, they were insanely beautiful. because what a scanner does is it removes space. And so the objects are on the surface of the glass, and they're super high resolution and super detailed. But there's really no shadow. There's no sense of light because it's an even, like the light is very even across the surface. And then depending on if the scanner is closed or open, you get a black space behind it or a white space behind it. And I just was sort of awestruck by how hair and litter and dirt and dust became the cosmos. And it just felt so much about what I was trying to make work about was how, you know, our days are made up of every day. They're not made up of the big moments. Our life is not made up of big moments. Our life is made up of sweeping your floor every day after dinner. You know, like that's actually what makes our life up, is these small, tiny moments. And I want to elevate those moments and ask people to notice them and even celebrate them. And it felt like by taking these sweepings and making them beautiful and relate to something so mysterious and not yet understood, felt really right. But I missed the labor. There's really no labor in that process. It's a very quick process. And that's when I started to draw them, because then I could bring in the meditative act of reflecting and sort of, it's almost like a form of prayer, drawing these meticulous, really obsessive almost drawings of dust. And I thought a lot about the dust also in the same way that the bed is, right? Like, we're surrounded by dust. It's everywhere. It's fascinating, the evidence of the bodies that are in dust. You can tell what color hair people have, which tells you what age they are. You can tell if they're animals. You can tell if they're plants. Like, there's so much information in the dust of a house that I found it really fascinating how they were really portraits of houses, mm-hmm. and portraits of moments, you know, like, you know, after a party, a birthday party, there were like sprinkles on the floor, or like after, like, you know, different things would be in the sweepings. But just like the bed, it's like, it's hidden. We like sweep it up and we hide it. All of this evidence of our life. It's like, it's the literal, like, this is the evidence of our body being in this space. Mm. But we just, it's like, culturally, you erase it. Mm. A good house is a clean house, you know, and we just discard it without even thinking about the fact that it's our bodies, it's our children's bodies, it's our, all the things we take care of and love's bodies. It's an evidence of like what's the environment and landscape we're in. So it became really interesting to me also, like how beautiful something we dismiss so easily could become if you abstracted it and you removed it from an environment and sort of let it speak to the cosmos, which is also just dust. You could say it's just dust too, just in a different way.
But it's the same.
That's what sort of led to there.
Yeah. But you get that when you see like macro photography of sand, don't you? Mm-hmm. You suddenly realize that sand is magnificent. These tiny little crystals, some are bound to be kind of alike. It's a numbers game. But I love what you're saying there about dust as well, you know, because it is. It's bits of us. It's bits of everything. And we just, like, we don't notice it. Then suddenly we notice it and we go, oh, my goodness, we've got a lot of it. But, yeah, we don't get to have the perspective on it that tells the tale of how the dust was made. But the more dust there mm-hmm. is in a place, presumably that means the more life has been in a place.
It's also, like, I think, also for me, part of what was interesting about it was because it did so immediately start to look like the cosmos. Like I didn't intend for that to happen initially. It just happened and the relationship was so present. I also find it like interesting of, you know, why do we love to look at the stars, right? Why do we love to stand at the edge of the ocean? Why does that feel so good? It's like so healing, right? When we do these things. And I've thought a lot about that when I started to make this work and really started to like read and research and think about what is the cosmos to a humanity, more in like a philosophical, psychological way. Because physics is, I do read some of the physics, but that's not as interesting to me. Is that I think, you know, we get so caught up in our big, you know, we think our lives are so big and they're so important, but they're not, right? We're blips of time. We're blips of time. And I think sometimes what feels good about looking up at a really beautiful star-filled night or standing at the edge of the ocean is how small we feel. And then all of our stuff isn't so important anymore. And we can feel relief in our smallness, and we can feel freedom in our smallness. And so I thought that that sort of philosophical thought towards that was really interesting, in that I was all of a sudden looking at kind of the smallest thing available to me. I mean, obviously there's a lot smaller things if we want to go scientific, but I don't want to go scientific. I want to go lived life. And so I think that was also really interesting to me, is how I could take this really small thing, the particles of dust on my floor, relate it to this vast thing that we are part of, but then also sort of relate it to the psychological conundrum of how important we think our problems and we are, and yet how good it feels when we realize that that's wrong. They're just not. They don't matter as much as we think they do. And that's become more and more of something that I've become really interested in exploring, understanding, and like communicating through the work.
And does that, I guess you get a lot of inner peace from that, because this is also a form of therapy that you're going through, isn't it? As well as the making, you're going through an exploration. I always think that, like, you know, it's almost like we're all, I'm going to get a bit metaphysical here, I have read a few books on the subject, but it's like we're all like bits of a flame that is the sun, you know, and we don't understand that we are the sun until we can be bits of flame and understand what it is to see this magnificent thing. And then suddenly we can understand that we're made of that thing. And that's the same that you're speaking to, isn't it? When we stare out into space forever, we suddenly realize how magnificent life is, in a way that we're often too swept up in our own bullshit to realize on a day to day.
Yeah. 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 So. And absolutely. It's like healing for me. I think, I mean, I've always worked somewhat autobiographically, and I think my work, like why I'm an artist, is really to try to understand the world and understand my place in the world and deal with the world and how hard it is to be a human sometimes. But I also think it's like painfully beautiful, but really beautiful. And so I think a lot of my work has always been about trying to come to terms with how it's so intensely beautiful to be present in this world and love people and be loved by people and witness the earth. But it's also really painful and really hard and really complicated. And so I think my work has always been about trying to understand that and figure that out for myself. And this work, I think, you know, we change and shift, and it's definitely about reminding myself of those things. But it's also, I think I've noticed how absent that sort of presence is in our busy, like our lives are so busy and so full, and there's so much information coming into us all the time, that, you know, is anyone noticing that the sun, which we are made of, like you said, is like passing across their face? That, you know, like, are we missing the whole point, you know, a little bit? And I feel like I've also somewhat, the art world for a while now has been kind of like ugly. It's been really interested in making ugly work about the ugliness of the world. And I don't think that's the role of art. I think art is, you know, to be transcendent. It's to be the guide. And I really have become really committed to like allowing beauty back into my practice and allowing and looking towards making art that can make people feel better instead of worse. Including myself, for sure. It's what I want to see. It's what, it's the art that moves me does that. That's the context I want to be part of. And like, I think the light part of my work has come in, and it's definitely the dominant subject that I've been interested in the last year, I'd say. It kind of accidentally, I mean, I'm a photographer, so I always have loved light. I've always used natural light. That's been my primary practice. And I think, you know, I think I became a photographer. Well, I don't think. I know I became a photographer because seeing latent light appear on a piece of paper in a bath of chemicals is the most amazing thing ever, to realize that we can hold and capture something that we still don't understand is really amazing.
There's a real elegance, there's a real simplicity to your choices to recreate the way light is creating shadow on a wall, those kind of things. There's such an innocence to that storytelling that you're not adding anything. You're going, here's a thing, and I'm going to capture that thing. You're documenting it again in a different way. But when you're saying about, you know, wanting to share beauty and wanting to focus on that, you can't necessarily get much less political than the way light hits a thing and reflects onto a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've wanted to, like, I've started to think about the word nothing a lot. And in my photography, I think I've really tried to, it's like I want to get as close to taking a photograph of nothing as possible, but it still be an interesting photograph. And I'm, because I think nothing is everything, right? Like, nothingness is everything. There, it's not empty, it's full in my mind. And so I don't think there has to be all of this, like, imagery for there to be something, you know, intensely moving, right? It's like a great poem doesn't have to be long. It can be three, you know, William Carlos Williams poem about the plums is one of my favorite poems. It's like, you know, it's three lines. That I think I'm really fascinated with how empty or how still or how quiet can something be and it still be moving. And I think that my work, I've really tried to remove all the noise. Like, I don't want any extra stuff anymore. And so I do sometimes question the light work because, like, currently what I'm doing is super, super simple aesthetically. It's, and it is literally documenting the shapes of light through different mediums, mostly through like a kind of like a reverse applique. And they're really simple. And so I think the intellectual artist says, oh, I need to do something more, but I don't, I think that sometimes we like hear all these voices that are telling us we have to do more and maybe we need to do less. And I've definitely been exploring that in my work, and negative space became so important to me in making the dust drawings and the dust pieces. The negative space was such an important part of like holding the abstraction of these particles. And so I think my consideration of negative space and my exploration of that in my work made me understand that like allowing more space can actually have more power than filling space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's a lot braver to say nothing than to say something.
Yeah. So I've kind of been exploring that and I'm still exploring that.
I mean, it's interesting because, so you said like prior to doing the sleepers piece, you spent quite a long time documenting your beds. And then you talked about with the dust, you kind of documented your floor sweepings and then made something from them. So in some ways, it's almost like you're just documenting another thing here. And who's to say what that will lead to? But the odds are it might lead to something else somewhere down the line, because that seems to be your track record. you document until the idea presents itself, and then you go and build something out of that. But I think there's a lot to be said for just, you know, like we've got a thing where when we go and walk the dog, we do stop and smell the roses, because if there are roses there to be smelled, you ought to go and stop and smell them. And I think there's just the paying attention to the small things and seeing the magic in those small moments. There's a cartoon that I love called mm-hmm. Bluey. It's a Australian cartoon.
My daughter loves it
Big
too.
Up your daughter.
I'm familiar.
It's quality. But you know, they have little things where sometimes they'll just show the light streaming through a window and some of the little dust motes just floating in front of the window. And those are the little things, and those are the little moments that's, you know, that's a complete intersection between the two things that you're paying attention to. And those are small bits of magic mm-hmm. that can mm-hmm. still, you know, like when people release loads of balloons, or when you see a hot air balloon festival, and we'll just all stare at it, won't we? Because it's so amazing. And it's like micro versions of those. It's just, I guess you're just mm-hmm. in the same way as needlework is often used to make people pay attention to stuff because of the choice of medium. You know, we get that a lot with politics, don't we? Where we'll take images and we'll needlework them, and therefore people reconsider them. And I'm not saying you're explicitly using needlework to that aim, but what you're doing is you're just presenting these situations for people that they wouldn't give any other thought to, and just offering them up for people for a chance to see the magic in it for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's what I hope to be doing, is to just invite the viewer to notice these things in their life in a different way. And like, definitely by making the dust work, I still sweep my floor all the time, but I have a more positive relationship to that. And when I clean my floor, it feels like a ritual almost. And then when I always see beauty in the pile before I put it up and throw it away. And I think, you know, I mean, I've always been a light witnesser because I've always loved light. I'm like a person that needs my apartment to have a lot of light. My studio always has to have a lot of light. Like I'm a person that loves being in light. But I feel like even still, even though I've always been that way, making this work has made me so acutely aware of how the light changes in my house through the seasons, like what time of year I can see this light shape or that light shape. How there's a different color to the light in the winter than in the summer. And generally when I wake up out of bed, the first thing I notice is the light shape in my bedroom that's there every day. And so I feel like it's created this like mapping of the beauty that is just constantly moving through my life and space, which we all have. We all live in space and we all have access to the sun somehow. But then it is really interesting how none of those shapes would exist without us, right? The sun is indifferent to these shapes, right? It's that we build these structures and we build these windows to let light in and air in, and they move across the objects and bodies that we've chosen to surround ourselves with. That I think it's really interesting that how I'm even seeing the beauty couldn't happen if I didn't have like a home and an environment in that home of certain objects. And so again, it's sort of this, there's still a portraiture aspect to it, because it's not just documenting light, it's documenting light in response to a specific place.
Yeah, like how the light plays off the musical instruments that you're providing because you've built those sculptures or whatever. You get that thing, if you get there's a thing, and then there's a thing that's not a thing. So thing, no thing. And then you get this bit in the middle that's like neither a thing nor a nothing. And it's almost like maybe that's the liminal. That's the liminal, isn't it, now that I think about it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that then, because you're a mother and you're a teacher, how does your change in perspective and change in practice inform your motherhood and your teacherhood?
Well, definitely in mothering is really when I started to notice and pay attention to the repetition that exists in life, because, you know, caregiving is so much about repetition. And so I think I needed to make that beautiful because it was not beautiful feeling. And so I think a lot of my interest in repetition and seeing routine and seeing the same thing over and over and over again has a lot to do with me coming to terms with the repetitive nature of caregiving. And so I think in a way, mothering informed the practice first. I mean, I always have worked somewhat serially, so it wasn't like absent in my practice beforehand, but I don't really think I thought about it that way. And I made a piece really specifically about that, where I embroidered wash, dry, fold, repeat over and over and over and over and over again. And it would be like wash, dry, fold, repeat, wipe butt, wash, dry, fold, repeat, kiss boo boo, wash, dry, fold, repeat, sing lullaby, wash, dry, fold, repeat, do dishes. And so there would be all of the monotonous things, but there would also be the beautiful things sort of tied into this wash, dry, fold, repeat language. And it was white thread on white fabric, so it was also very invisible. I'm intended to be like long period series over the many layers of mothering, of invisible labor, all the like invisibility of the labor of caregiving. And I think that while I was making that piece and the sort of pieces surrounding that time period, I was really looking for a way to find beauty in the boring and beauty in the banal and in the everyday and in all of the stuff that we are not taught culturally by movies that they are beautiful. And so I think there are other reasons why, I've been practicing yoga for almost 30 years. Mm. So I think that practice has informed my outlook on life significantly, of trying to find beauty and presence. But so I think the work that I'm making now was really informed by that work. And as far as like mothering, I think, you know, I just want my kids to be able to be present. Mm. And so I'm really strict about screen time. even though we do have screens in our household, we're pretty strict about screen time. I make my kids meditate sometimes. I point out a lot of things to, you know, I'm always pointing out, oh, look at this. Isn't it beautiful? Mm. Because I can't help myself. I just want to like share the things I see. I'm a very visual person and I just want to be like, look. And then I think a lot about both my husband and I's partnering is about giving our kids space, which involves a lot of things. And in teaching, I mean, I think I can't help but share artists and talk about work that is about contemplation, because that's where my area of fascination is. But I do think I also really talk about beauty in a different way than a lot of contemporary instructors might. I think that in the art world, beauty kind of has become a bad word. And not as much in photography, because in photography, it kind of has to exist, because that's what makes a photograph have punctum or not. So I don't think in photography it's quite as strongly anti-beauty. But the word is still pretty like misused. And I think it's really, I heard, oh my gosh, I'm forgetting her name. She's a conceptual photographer, and I'll think of her name. But I read an interview on her, and she talked about beauty and art of like, you have to seduce the viewer. Because if you want to make work about a subject that is difficult in any way, why would they look at it? Why would they contemplate it? And I definitely talk about work a lot that way now. Like, for instance, I talk about Kara Walker's work in one of the classes I teach, because it's a really great example of positive negative space. And her work is really beautiful. Like, formally, her work is really beautiful. And it's about an extremely difficult subject matter. And I talk about how she's using beauty to have the viewer engage and be like curious and like intrigued. And then only after she's sort of seduced and sucked the viewer in, then you realize what the content is. Mm. But by then you're already there. And so I think as an instructor, I talk a lot about that, and I point out how contemporary artists are actually using it as a tool to engage their viewers. Even when they're making work about subjects that are and content that is like very not beautiful. And so I think it definitely influences my teaching in that way. And I think I also like talk a lot about being present, especially, especially in like my drawing and photography classes is like, it's about looking carefully. Like to me, being a great artist is really being a great looker. Like you look well, you see well, and that all of a sudden allows you to make things that are visual. And so we do a lot of exercises that are just about learning to see better and see more carefully. And obviously the way you do that through photography and drawing is really different, but it's also not. It's just you're using different tools. And so I really enjoy kind of bringing that conversation in and having it not just, like to me, doing a really excellent observational drawing is not about technique. It's about learning to see extremely well. Mm. And so that's more of how that's the type of language that I use when I'm teaching stuff like that.
It's like not accepting things at face value, which is what like we do in life anyway, don't we? We just see a thing and we just take it for granted or whatever, but you're saying.
Or we think we know something and we don't see it, you know, like it's like if you're drawing a chair, everybody knows a chair has four legs, but a lot of perspectives of a chair, you don't see four legs. Mm. And people, especially when they're drawing from life, they will draw what they know instead of what they actually see. Like they don't trust their eyes to actually know better than them because they can't let go of like the intellectual knowledge of a chair or a person or whatever it is, you know, a familiar object. It's actually much easier to draw things you're less familiar with because you are not listening to your brain. You have to look. That it's not only like do we take things at face value, we also like don't trust our own vision, our own witnessing. We trust what we know more than what we know by seeing.
And what we know is what we've been told more often than not as well. So
right. Yeah. Exactly.
I was thinking about what you're saying a minute ago, and I wondered what the difference between routine and ritual is. Because you talk about routines a lot, but then I think rituals, yoga is a good example of that. That feels like it's routines with beauty or something. I don't know.
I think they're routines with intention. I think it's intention. I think, you know, anything, you know, like in Buddhism, they like can talk about like how, you know, when you're doing your dishes, it can become like this really strong meditation. And then it becomes a ritual. As soon as it becomes that, it's a ritual. It's no longer you're doing the dishes. You are doing the dishes with a sense of intention. And so it becomes a ritual. So I don't think it has to be beautiful to be a ritual. But I do think it has an intentional awareness to it. And I think that I think we've become a much more secular culture and we've lost ritual as a result. But I think humans need ritual. We need ritual in our lives. I think it creates meaning to the everyday monotony of being alive. It creates the potential for beauty. But because we've become more and more secular, it's become a little bit lost and there hasn't been a replacement for it. And I think that I know that I have looked for it a lot because I was raised going to church and I don't go to church and I miss the ritual. I don't miss the dogma, but I miss the ritual. And I miss that for my children. And I've had that conversation with lots of people that are of my generation that maybe did grow up with religion, but have not continued in a traditional way, having that relationship. But seeking the desire to still have ritual in their lives and to create ritual for their children. And I think that we are really looking for that as a culture and the greater world is so like sort of smushed together now that like the greater world culture is looking for returning ritual, because I think that intentionality does create meaning.
Mm. Yeah. It makes you realize why people love, I don't know, craft groups. craft groups provide rituals, don't they? Right. It's that kind of community.
Absolutely.
Without the dogma, all brought together around a joined passion.
Absolutely. And it also creates, like, you know, like coming around a table to do a lap project, right? It also, it create you come to the table, right? You have to make the choice to come to the table. And then there's something about having a project in your hands that you can be sort of passively doing because you can actively listen or talk, that our barriers drop. And it's different than when you're around a table with nothing in your hands. That I'm amazed at the conversations that happen around my workshop tables or when I'm like helping a residency, of the level of depth of conversation that you can have and the level of laughter and conversation you can have. And I think there's something about coming to the table, but also having something active. So you are not being passive, but you can just, it's like we can, all of a sudden we can be more present because we have this thing in our hand that we're doing. That I do think there's a ritualistic quality to that. And there's, because gathering with intention is a ritual. And I do think there's an attraction to that for people. I mean, even just like, you know, anything, like if you're just like, I'm going to knit every day after I put my kids to bed, that's creating a ritual. It's like intending something and doing it. And it creates meaning to the sort of what happens after my kids go to bed or something. But I also think the rise of like handmade craft textile based practices is also like our lives have gotten so far away from tactile objects, right? And so I think we want to make things. We want to see our bodies produce something beautiful. And craft is a really accessible way to do that. It's not expensive. It doesn't have to be intellectualized. It does have a lot of passive labor in it. Like there's a lot of thinking labor, but then there's a lot of I just have to do. I have to just sew. I have to just count stitches. I have to just quilt these pieces together or piece these pieces together. That I think it provides an opportunity of tactility that isn't, it's not so, it's hard work, but it's a different type of hard work. It's not like we have to be like thinking the whole time. We can just be like, I stitched for an hour and a half yesterday and it was the best hour and a half of my day. Because I just was with a needle and a seed stitch and deciding which direction do I go? Which color of yellow do I pick up? Which way do I want to fill this shape? And I didn't have to think about anything else. And that's rare right now in our lives, is like being able to just like really focus on something, but not in an, it's not exhausting to make, you know, that's like it's a quiet focus. It's a small focus. I mean, I stitched for an hour and a half and probably got an inch and a half done, you know? Like, so there's no rushing it, right? You cannot rush textiles. It doesn't work. No matter what you try to do, if you need to fill a 2-inch by 10-foot shape with seed stitches, it's going to take the same amount of time that it's going to take no matter what. There's no way to speed it up. And so I think there's a surrender in that of there's no way that I can do this more effectively, more efficiently, more quickly, unless I use technology, which then that's a different process. That's completely different. And I think almost like the forcedness of not being able to speed it up is very fulfilling and healing during this time where we're so overstimulated.
I like to think of it as like doing good work. So it's like, you know, it can be hard. It can take a long time. But no, that's the point. It's not hard. It might take time and it might require effort, but it's not a struggle. It's like the right kind of work, you know, in the same way as, I don't know, raising kids is probably the right kind of work if you do need your property or something.
And I also think that in some way for me, like that translates to yoga as well. Like there's I come from a traditional practice, Ashtanga, which is it's a very repetitive practice. There's a specific sequence. You do the sequence. You don't move on to the second sequence till you've mastered the first sequence. And I think learning that and understanding the value of that, there's also no rushing. I mean, you can practice more, and so you would get there quicker by practicing more often. But there's no way to get to like a perfect backbend without years of practice. That's the only way. It's the only way to get there. And so I think sometimes like for me, that was really, I'm a little bit of a control freak person, and like letting go of control and just letting my body do the work, was also very liberating. And I found like a lot of release in no longer striving for something, but just trusting that with practice I would arrive. And I think in some ways, like textiles, just like, it's like the same thing. Like I can have like this piece that I'm doing seed stitches on. It's going to take me forever to make this piece. But I also know that if I keep showing up and stitching for an hour and a half and getting an inch and a half filled, one day I will be like, oh, it's done. Like all of my other pieces, they eventually get done and then they're done and I've arrived. And I think being able to trust in the process of time and showing up is it's not something that a lot of our life we can trust right now, of like just showing up, we'll get reward, right? Or just showing up, we will get success of any kind. But I think with certain types of making practices, all you really do have to do is show up and make, and with time it will be there. And if you want it to be perfect, well, it's not going to be the first time you do it, but if you keep showing up and you keep making, all of a sudden they are perfect. And my students are always like, how do you make such a perfect stitch? I have no idea. I know how I made a perfect stitch, actually. I have stitched thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of hours. That is how my stitch is perfect. There's no way that I can teach that. I can teach you how to do a stitch, but to make it perfect in your body with your hands in the way that you make marks, the only way to do that is by stitching for thousands and thousands of hours, or hundreds and hundreds. That, you know, I think there's also like a level of letting go that has to happen as well, because there's no speeding up that. I think, you know, textile processes are so in the body. They're so in your body of like, how do you hold your hand? How do you, you know, like, how do you, even like teaching someone to thread a needle, it's the hardest thing to teach someone to thread a needle, because no matter what you do, they're in their head and you're like, well, this is what I do and this is how I do it. And they're like, it just doesn't make sense till it makes sense. And once you know how to thread a needle, you're like, how did I ever not know how to thread a needle? You know, it's so simple. But I think there's something beautiful about how there are certain physicalities to making that can't be taught. They have to be felt. And I think definitely as a teacher, I really try to teach that, because I don't want people to make work like me. I don't want to teach them how to make my work. I don't want to teach them how to make my mark. You know, I want them, which is sometimes really intimidating to my students, because I give them nothing. There's no sampler. There's nothing to respond to. Like, they have to come up with their own thing that they have to respond to, because that has meaning for them. Me giving them, like, why do you want to draw what I draw, you know? But I really want them to feel their own way through the process, even if they resist it strongly, which sometimes they do. They're like, who is this crazy lady?
That's probably what's quite nice in, like you were saying, with the course, where you give them a found object, because at least they're not starting with nothing. Mm-hmm. They're starting with a thing, and then it's up to them, the moves that they make. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you can show them marks, but they won't be their marks.
Right.
They've got to put a lot of marks in, right, yeah.
And I think the way that I think about embroidery is so much, it's what I love about embroidery over other needle arts is that it is just a mark. There's really no rules. I mean, there are rules to certain stitches, but even those, it's an oral tradition. It's like one book says do it this way, one book says do it this way, you know? And so to me, it is just marks. And so we don't have to get so caught up on what's right or wrong as far as the book or the Royal School of Needlework says, but like what's right or wrong for what you are wanting to express? What's right or wrong for your mark making? Because that's what makes an art piece vital, right? Is like, you know, like Egon Schiele is a great example of that. Like if his line didn't quiver, we wouldn't be obsessed with him. You know, if it was, it is perfect. It's so perfect, but it's also so imperfect. And that is why there are few draftsmen of such simplicity that are so revered and loved, is because he embraced the way he made a line. And then he made perfect, beautiful drawings with that line. But I think, you know, I think that is when I teach, that's so much a part of how I talk about embroidery and how I think about embroidery. So then I can't give them my own, like people say, well, why don't you give us a sampler? And I'm like, I just can't do that. Then it's like completely in conflict with what I am like promoting in embroidery as an art form.
Yeah. And do you think then you just have to instill the confidence in them to say, start making marks, know that these marks are the best marks you'll make at this point in time, and don't think about the marks you make in 10 years time, because who's to say?
Absolutely. I mean, I talk about that in all of my classes, I think. And you know, when you're teaching workshops, you're often not teaching. I mean, usually you have a mix of artists and people that have like are just doing it for pleasure or curiosity. And you definitely have to create confidence. And, you know, like we might do some drawing exercises so then they can respond to a drawing they do. I encourage people to bring photographs to work from, and I talk about how to work from photographs so then they could maybe respond to a photograph. I always have samplers that are really simple, like just a word, or really simple hand-drawn samplers, so then they could take a cue off of that. And so there's lots of different ways, but my language is always about, well, if you want to do it perfect, this is how you could do it, but maybe you don't want to do it perfect, so try it this way and this way and this way. Because I also think, you know, like hand embroidery it's not machine embroidery. It's not, I don't want to see a perfect hand embroidery. I want to see like the way that person embroiders, and what threads do they use, and how do they use those threads, and are they perfect or imperfect? It's like, you know, like with Agnes Martin paintings, the ones where you see her finger bump on the lines are worth way more than the ones that she probably considered perfect. And so it's because there's the mark of her hand. You see it right there. You see that's her finger being bumped when she hit the ruler or was drawing the line. And so to me, I would much rather see an imperfect piece of stitching that is that person than a perfect piece, because a perfect piece, I can't see the maker. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, a set musician versus like a really famous musician, right? A set musician is usually a much better musician, because they have to be able to drop into any situation and play it perfectly. But the famous musician plays it like they play it. They're doing it their way with their interpretation, which is sometimes quote unquote wrong, but that's why we love it, because it's not the way that we are used to seeing it or hearing it. And I feel like when I teach, especially in embroidery, because people want the perfection, and like I'm so like not that teacher. That I fight against that, because there's other people that can provide that for them. So I'm just going to be the anti that.
but then your work shows that there's perfection in the things that we don't think are perfect. You know, there's universes to be found in bags of dust. There's, you know, transcendent situations to be found in the light bouncing off a piece of fabric on a wall or whatever. So it's like, who's to say what perfection is, right?
Right. Exactly.
Just get over it.
Exactly.
Move along.
Well, and that's what I, you know, the perfect is imperfect, the imperfect is perfect sort of thing, right? That idea.
And that's the way it's meant to be, right?
I would think so.
Was it like Andy Warhol was supposed to have made like 81,000 pieces of work, because he had a factory and he had a system, and there was something like at one point 12% of all the art for sale was like from Andy Warhol or whatever. But it's like that one probably is like his art probably isn't in the output. It's probably in the gaming the system or something, right? Because I mean, he would just do 100 prints of the same thing or whatever. So it's kind of like, I guess the artistry in his case is what top level manipulating the system based artistry or something, rather than the production of the pieces at the bottom.
Oh yeah, I mean, his work is so much about the concept of production, right? Like that's what his work is about. Or in like, you know, it's in somewhat, you know, Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst are coming out of that like genre of like it's I mean, they're both, I think, perfectionists in many ways, but you know, their work is about production. Their work is about the art world. Their work is about visual media. And so, you know, Andy Warhol made mass produced art because his work was very much about the consumer culture and the production of celebrity and all of these things that were connected to mass production. And so I think that it makes sense that he made a lot of work. I mean, that's part of his work, is that it's everywhere.
Yeah,
it is producible in mass quality. It's not about the labor of the making, even though there's plenty of labor in the making. That's not what it's about. It's about the content of the idea of our information sort of society. That was like the beginning of information society, right? And he was in response to that, that it wouldn't be the same if there wasn't a ton of it.
This makes me think, if I ever choose to become an artist, I should just make the one thing and just be done with that. Maybe try and do the exact opposite and then disappear from view or something. I'm going to pivot on to I sent you these questions ahead of schedule.
Yes,
I think,
you
hopefully.
Did. You
Let's
did.
See how this goes, because this is always quite nice.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite album?
Well, I listen to a lot of music. I have lots of genres that I listen to, but I think if I had to pick a couple, like if I had to be on a deserted island with one album, I think it would be John Coltrane's Blue Train.
Yeah.
I love jazz music, and it's just like music that it never gets on your nerves. It's always like, it's like a warm friend for me. I also really, really love Max Richter's Vivaldi's Four Seasons. If you haven't heard it, everybody should listen to it. It's an incredible classical album by the contemporary composer.
See, the one he slightly reworked it, hasn't he? I think I can hear one of the songs in my head is more like repetitions.
He recomposed it, yes.
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful. And then as far as more contemporary music, I'm definitely like a super fan of The Cure. Probably Blood Flowers is my favorite album, and then I listen to the Velvet Underground all the time, speaking of Andy Warhol.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And their album with Nico is my favorite album, and on repeat in my studio.
Do you listen to certain types of music when you're working, or do you have different types of music for different types of work?
I'm a mood based music picker. So I do listen to music a lot in the studio. I also listen to podcasts a fair amount, but I come and go. Sometimes I need less voices, and sometimes I'm like need voices. I listen to all kinds of music. Yeah. I mean, those four albums are definitely popular in the studio. But yeah, it's pretty mood based.
You got any podcast recommendations? Obviously, Needle Exchange goes without saying, but anyone's other than
obviously.
That.
Well, I listen to lots of poetry podcasts. I mean, most people, I'm sure, well, maybe not. Poetry Unbound is an amazing podcast put out by the On Being Project. It's just a phenomenal, relatively short, you know, they're between 15 and 20 minutes long. They're a poem read by the host, and then he sort of interprets the poem for you and then reads it again. It's a fabulous podcast. I listen to like lots of art podcasts. I can't think of what I listen to right now, but all the big ones I listen to. I've gone through phases. I'm kind of in a non-podcast phase, so they're all not like up in my head right now. There's one really great one, though. Is it? Oh, I feel bad because it's she started it here. And if people don't know about it, it's really good. It's about art history. But it's her tagline is the Lonely Palette. It's like art history for the masses. And so she's a trained art historian. She used to work here in Boston at the MFA, and she's in Ohio now, I think. But it's a fabulous podcast that talks about major works of art in art history, but in a way that really humanizes the story of the work. And that could be through the lens of the artist or the moment in time that that art was made, or maybe the journey that that artwork has gone through. But it's very fun and playful and conversational, but also really great exposure to like the greatest masterworks of our time. That's a good one.
I shall stick both. Yeah. I like it. The thing is, poetry is definitely one of those media I'm not that familiar with. I'm more limerick than poetry, I'd say. So mm-hmm. It's quite nice to, you know, dive into that, get pushed out of my comfort zone. Favorite book?
My favorite book is Day Book by Anne Truitt. Anne Truitt was a minimalist sculptor and a mother of three. And she wrote a book kind of mid-career. It's really just about being an artist and figuring out all of that stuff. But it's an incredible book. Any artist that hasn't read it should. It's a seminal sort of autobiographical, non-pretentious, very real book about that process. I definitely connected to it even more so as a mother. So that's a book like I go back to over and over and over again, and is definitely probably one of my most beloved books. And then I also love Gaston Bachelard's Poetics of Space. He was a philosopher and psychologist, I think, French, that wrote about space in a philosophical way, but with science knowledge. And it's a little bit dense, but it's really beautiful. He's very poetic in the way he writes. And so that's a book that like I often like I've read it from front to back a few times, but more in recent years, it's like I'll just pick it up and open it when I'm sort of contemplating my work, because my work has so much to do with space. Mm. And then my COVID project was to read Marcel Proust's Lost in Time.
Okay.
And so I am halfway through the sixth of the seven books. Wow. So I've read thousands and thousands of pages of it, and I'm so close. And I will finish it probably before the end of this year. But Alain de Botton wrote a book called Proust Will Change Your Life. And I have decided he is correct. If you actually read Proust, which I don't think most people will, because it's an insane commitment. But, you know, I make giant embroideries. And it has definitely changed my life and a profoundly important book to me now, even though I still have not yet finished it. But it's like a bazillion pages, so. Seven books. So
that day book sounds a bit like the sort of book that you'd write.
I would love to write a day book that is as good as her day book. Yeah, it does. Yes. It's just her being a real person. And at that time, she had just had a really large scale show at the Guggenheim, which, of course, the Guggenheim wasn't what it is now. And she had a show coming up at the Corcoran. So she was a really established artist. But she was at that time a single mother. She had divorced her husband and he was no longer in the country and was raising three kids. And she's just a human, you know? I mean, and I love her work. It's beautiful, but it's not really my type of work. It's very, very minimalist. So I'm not so much connecting to it over an aesthetic connection. But I think just being able to witness the reality of someone whose life parallels yours is a real privilege, especially when it's said with honesty.
Yeah, that would be really nice. I don't think there'll be a book written by anyone that parallels my life. That would be dreadful. Do you have a favorite film?
Not really. I'm not a huge movie TV person. I mean, I enjoy them for sure, but I'm not like a repeat watcher. I used to always say Amelie the French film Amelie. I think it's like so beautiful and whimsical. But yeah, I don't really think I have a favorite film because I'm like a one and done.
Your favorite film could be The Passing of Sunlight Through My Studio Window by Joetta Maui. That kind of
thing. Yeah, that's my favorite film.
That's cool. And then is there a very interesting thing about you that nobody else really knows?
Well, I pondered this question and wondered maybe I'm not very interesting. I don't really know that there's something super. I mean, I just am obsessed with my art and do art all the time. I have done yoga for 30 years. And I think that that's, I started in high school and it's a huge part of my life, even when I'm not doing it. And a fun fact is I was a natural wine buyer for 10 years. So I have a ridiculous amount of knowledge about natural wine and an excellent palate.
What's natural wine as opposed to wine?
Wine would be called conventional wine. Mm-hmm. Natural wine means that, like, conventional wine has a lot of chemicals in it because that's how, you know, they can make a ton of wine, and you can know that when you buy whatever Charles Shaw Cabernet, it will taste exactly like that. And really the way that they do that is by using chemicals to stabilize the wine, as well as using like a controlled sort of yeast situation, because wine is actually very alive. It's a living thing. So they have to kind of stop it from living in order for it to taste the same and be predictable, especially over different vintages, because the vintage can so much affect the grapes. Whereas natural wine embraces all of that. And so instead there is little to be truly natural, there's no chemicals, but no added chemicals. Instead of using packaged yeast, they might have open vats. So it's like the yeast in the air. And then as a result, the wine, you know, it's meant to be consumed more quickly. It's not really meant to be sitting on a shelf aging, though there are some natural wines that are appropriate for that. And they use a lot less or no chemicals. They use biodynamic farm processes usually, which is like herbs and things like that. So their yields each year are really different based on the weather, based on the rain, based on all of that stuff. And so one vintage to the next will be profoundly different, maybe never to be seen again type of vintage. And a lot of times because they're smaller farmers, they're like using lesser known grapes. They're using ancestral grapes or native grapes. So they're not so much focused on like, oh, I've got to make Cabernet Sauvignon. They could be doing that, but they're more often using older grapes that naturally grow on the land more easily.
Do you have a favorite wine?
Do I have a favorite wine?
Do you have are there ones like, I like a good red wine. I quite like a good Shiraz, sometimes a bit of a Merlot. I even feel like I'm doing it wrong now because it's like, no, that's not what the natural people call them because they're all the same or something. But
well, they could be called that. I'm seasonal. I love orange wine. I'm more of like an adventure wine drinker. I like to try something different. When I go to a restaurant, especially if they offer natural wine, I kind of say, what's the weirdest one you have? That's the one I want to try. I love a good rosé in the summer. That means for me, very clean, mineral driven and dry. And then in the winter, I do like red wine, but I don't like big reds. I want to taste the terroir. So a lot of California reds are like, they're essentially, California is like the perfect place to grow grapes. So like they're really juicy. So they all kind of taste the same because they're like in perfect conditions. Whereas in imperfect conditions, a grape kind of has to struggle. And so you end up tasting that struggle because it's sucking the minerals out of the ground sort of thing. And so I tend to like a lighter red so that I can taste the different influences of its environment. I most often would probably drink a French red.
No, I like that. I like the adventure wine. I'll be an adventure wine person. That sounds like a good place to be.
Yeah, it's fun.
If people would like to find out more about you, where should they turn?
Well, my Instagram is a great source, which is just my name, Joetta Maui. I obsessively share about process because that's my jam. So I post quite a bit on there, partially just because I want to document it. But it's nice that there's a feedback loop and a community that engages. And then my website is also Joetta Maui. I just updated it yesterday. What?
Wow. Exciting. Very first exciting. Update in 15 years, everybody.
And maybe two. It was a pretty big update. But, you know, if you want to see more formal work, you can go there and read all about my bio and all that fun stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Hey, Joetta. Thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thanks, Jamie, for having me. It was great.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's NEEDL.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's NEEDL.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.